I guess this rarely happens, but I guess it happened in spades with the Gospel of Judas. Here is a document, an ancient document, a bona fide ancient document, of some significance, but I don't know if it's as significant as the press made it out to sound, the Gospel of Judas, that for some reason was the cause celeb for about the last year. It was on magazine covers. It was everywhere. A lot of people found it. They read it, and they said, okay, so what's the big deal? We'll answer that question here during this half hour of Issues, etc. What's the big deal with regard to the Gospel of Judas? And then what's the big deal with regard to all the coverage that it got in the press? Dr. Daniel Hoffman joins us here in just a few minutes. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. You're listening to Issues, etc., and we're coming to you live this Thursday, the 7th of December. You can join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We were talking a few minutes ago with Pastor Stuckwish about Ambrose and the great hymns that he left to the church. Well, here's one, and this is a section of a hymn by Martin Luther that is especially near and dear to my heart. See if you remember this one. Welcome to earth, O noble guest, through whom the sinful world is blessed. You came to share my misery, that you might share your joy with me. It's just one of the sections of the Luther hymn called From Heaven Above to Earth I Come, and it is, in fact, part of the text of our Issues, etc., Book of the Month for December, called From Heaven Above, written by Luther. It's a children's picture book set around that famous Christmas hymn by Martin Luther. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. It would make a great Christmas gift, especially as we're bearing down upon the holiday. To find out more about it, go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask them about the Issues, etc., Book of the Month for December, From Heaven Above. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. For the next 20 minutes or so, the Gospel of Judas is our subject. Dr. Daniel Hoffman is Associate Professor of History at Lee University in Cleveland, Tennessee. He's author of the book, The Status of Women and Gnosticism, Irenaeus to Tertullian. And he also has written the cover story for the latest Christian Research Journal titled The Fictitious Gospel of Judas and Its Sensational Promotion. Dr. Hoffman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for having me.
What's the big deal about the Gospel of Judas itself? And then let's talk about why it became such a big deal for about the last year or so in the press.
Well, I think it's mainly because of the media promotion, as you were talking about earlier. But it is pretty rare for ancient documents like this to come to light. It is a document from the late 3rd century, early 4th century, and finds like that are pretty rare, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi texts, a few other things like this, but there hasn't been another comparable document found in the last 10 to 20 years that I'm aware of.
So give us just the synopsis, if you would, of the Gospel of Judas. What does it contain for those who haven't given all the coverage, who haven't taken the time to read this little thing?
Well, it's certainly quite different than what you would think it says if you saw the National Geographic documentary on television in April during Easter week this year. It begins with a Passover kind of a meal, presumably the Passover just before Jesus is arrested. And the main character, unlike the accounts from the first century, the canonical Gospels, that certainly have it much more accurate historically, in the Gospel of Judas, the main character is Judas. And it talks about him and his interactions with the Jesus character of this story. I'll say that because in lots of ways it's a fictional sort of a story that has little relation to the Jesus of the first century and the canonical Gospels. And in this story, the Gospel of Judas, it has Jesus saying various things to Judas and the other disciples that promote the worldview or the opinions of a second century group, the Gnostics, listeners may have heard of these folks. They were fairly common in the second century, and they believed that salvation was by knowledge, that is, by teachings that only they knew, or at least only they claimed to know. And so in one sense, the Gospel of Judas is a document that claims to have some of this secret elite kind of teaching that these Gnostics valued so highly. But the really interesting, or in some ways ironic, thing about it is that most of these teachings had already been known to scholars today, because the Orthodox Christian writers, people like Irenaeus that you mentioned just a second ago, had described the teachings of these groups and thoroughly refuted what they had to say. And so there isn't really a whole lot of new stuff in the Gospel of Judas, except the sort of sensational idea that the world's foremost traitor could somehow be transformed into a good guy. And that's what the press played on. I think they went way too far with even a what the document itself claims. But I think that was the fascination, that somehow this character who committed one of the worst possible deeds in the world, according to most folks for the last 2,000 years in the Western tradition at least, could somehow really have been a good guy.
What were the second century Gnostics' interests in recasting the not only the relationship between Jesus and Judas, but recasting both Jesus and Judas in the Gnostic mold? What were they attempting to do, and how did they go about it?
Well, they were attempting to further their particular view of this world and the afterlife. And it's quite clear if you read the Gospel of Judas that the supposed teaching of Jesus that's contained in it is very similar to other teachings that we know about, where there are many gods and goddesses. They begin with a exalted heavenly being who then creates other gods and goddesses in pairs, until eventually moving away from that original good being, some kind of a god creates the world. And the Gnostics believed, most of them at least, that the physical and material world that we can see and touch was at least tainted in some ways, if not outright evil. And so if they believed that there was some sort of good being to begin with, how did they get to the evil world? Well, it's through this host of heavenly beings that ultimately one of them creates the world. And so you really have, in the Gospel of Judas, the Jesus character explaining all of this to Judas. And so it would seem that a particular branch of the Gnostics, who elevated Cain, another person in the Old Testament who wasn't exactly a hero, that this particular branch of the Gnostics wanted this teaching to back up their own views. So they sort of created a supposedly sacred writing in order to legitimate the views that they were already teaching.
What claims, it's kind of a two-pronged approach to this subject, what claims were made and have been made by the press regarding the Gospel of Judas that you deem to be overblown or untrue?
Well, they would say things like the National Geographic dust cover, for example, on the actual edition of the Gospel of Judas said, far from being a villain, Judas that emerges from the pages of this text is a hero, and that Jesus asks Judas to betray him, and that Judas is a role model for all of those who wish to be disciples of Jesus. All of those things are really baloney, even if you take the Gospel of Judas at face value, because there is no statement in the Gospel of Judas where Jesus asks Judas to betray him. So that's just an outright lie, even if you think that this second century fictitious gospel has some sort of history to it. Now, the manuscript is in very poor condition. There are lots of gaps in it, and so it's hypothetically possible that it did say that at one point, but in the text that's been published, there is no such statement. The closest thing is there's a statement where Jesus says to Judas, "You will exceed all of them," that is, all the other disciples, "for you will sacrifice the man that clothes me." A very strange sort of a saying, but it's only understandable in light of the Gnostic view that the physical body is evil. And so this Jesus character would be saying to Judas, somehow through some sort of sacrifice, you are going to be able to liberate the spirit that is within this deficient or perhaps evil body that I have. But exactly how Judas was going to do that is never spelled out in the text. In fact, the text never talks about the physical death and certainly not the resurrection of Jesus, because the Gnostics didn't believe in that. They thought the body was evil. They're not going to have this fictitious Jesus rise in a new body because bodies were bad. So anyway, I hope I haven't gone on too long with
that. No, that's fine. The bottom line here at this point in the conversation seems to be that as an authentic second century document penned by Gnostics of the second century, the Gospel of Judas is more valuable in telling us about what Gnostics believed at the time than what really happened between Jesus and Judas in any sense.
Yes, that's certainly true, and I think that the themes that are present in the Gospel of Judas, where there are clearly some Jewish elements, they praise character Seth from the Old Testament. They use a number of references to El, the Hebrew name for God, and various other things that show sort of a Jewish root to some of their philosophical views, and also Platonic views. For example, the Gospel of Judas talks about every person having a star that guides them, and that's an idea that goes back to Plato, very popular today in songs and, you know, children's stories even because of Disney, but ultimately Plato was the guy who talked about that the most. And so these sort of Jewish and Platonic themes within the Gospel of Judas might let scholars sort of figure out how the overall theory of Gnosticism, what I would call certainly a cult, an offshoot of Christianity, how it arose. It took a little bit of ideas from Judaism and from Greek thinking and merged it with Christian thinking to create a sort of an elitist group. In fact, that's another misleading element in the whole story where they try to say Judas is a role model for all those who want to follow Jesus. That's not true even in the text. It's quite clear that Judas is one of the elite, one of the few who really understands it and really gets it. The rest of the disciples, who represent the ordinary Christians, they are sort of sloughed off, laughed at by this Jesus character.
But that's really, you affirmed, that's really a picture of the mindset of those Gnostics at the time as they were encountering Orthodox Christianity.
Absolutely.
They did, as many modern-day Gnostics today would, consider themselves the cognoscendi.
Right.
Among a mass of ignorant and probably not genuine Christians.
Yes, and other Gnostic texts do the same kind of thing. The famous Gospel of Mary has Mary being the enlightened one, the one who understands Jesus. So Judas wouldn't have been the hero for all Gnostics by any means. I think they used whoever seemed to be able to fit their mold the best, and each of them seems to have been organized around a charismatic kind of teacher, perhaps a cult figure would be a better way to say it. And so they each sort of tried to appropriate their own character from the Bible, especially the New Testament, as the one who could legitimate their teaching. The Gospel of Thomas is sometimes used as a similar kind of a gospel. So there were lots of these kinds of gospels out there, and that's another reason why it's not particularly surprising that the ideas of the Gospel of Judas would come to light. The really amazing thing is the whole story about how it was found and how it was preserved and how it was sold. I mean, they could make a true blockbuster story about that, I think.
I want to hear about that in just a second. I got one more question. This is always, whenever we've talked about the Gnostics and their various Gospels and whatnot, it is always stuck in the back of my mind. Did the writers of these Gnostic Gospels and those among whom they circulated, did they regard these as the genuine article, or did they regard them as what kind of mythological apologies in the face of the canonical Gospels? Did they believe them?
Well, that's really an interesting question, a good question. In other words, you're asking, you know, why would a person in, you know, say 130, 140 A.D. sit down and pen a fictitious gospel? I think they believed, or at least a few people among them believed, that these were the kinds of things that perhaps should have been said by Jesus to Judas. Perhaps they believe they could have been said, or they were really the proper and appropriate interpretation of what had been recorded as the sayings of Jesus. So they wanted to go farther and perhaps go higher and deeper in some ways. And so I guess some people were a bit more unscrupulous about that and were willing to put words back into the mouth of these characters, thinking that these were the kinds of things they should have said, but we have no evidence that they actually did say any of the things that are ascribed to them in these various Gnostic Gospels.
Folks, if you've heard about the Gospel of Judas, maybe you have a question or a comment. We've got a few minutes left in our conversation with Dr. Daniel Hoffman, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Hoffman is Associate Professor of History at Lee University in Cleveland, Tennessee, author of the book The Status of Women in Gnosticism, Irenaeus to Tertullian, and he's written the cover story for the latest Christian research journal titled The Fictitious Gospel of Judas and Its Sensational Promotion. Tell us the story, with a few minutes left here, of how it was discovered, how it was preserved, and how it eventually made it into the limelight.
Well, that is the fascinating part of the story, at least to me. It was apparently found by Egyptians in the Nile Valley, not too far from where another larger collection of Gnostic texts had been found in the 1940s. This Gospel of Judas was apparently found in the 1970s, again in an area of Egypt where there are a number of Coptic Christians. These are Christians that go back to a very early days of Christianity who use a language called Coptic, that is a little bit related to Greek. And anyway, the current Gospel of Judas is written in that language, in Coptic, and so based on the spelling and the writing, we can tell that it comes from the 3rd or perhaps early 4th century. And then there was also a radiocarbon dating of part of the papyrus, which is what it was written on, that gave a date of 280 A.D. So it obviously comes from an era when there were Christians in Egypt, and apparently some of them, for whatever reason, perhaps being followers of the Gnostic teachings, or perhaps even wanting to have a copy in order to refute the Gnostic teachings, just like I have in my office a copy of the Book of Mormon, even though I don't believe that it contains accurate religious teaching for us today. Anyway, that's another story. They preserved this. It was apparently put in with the burial of a person around 280 or so A.D. And then in modern times, some Egyptians found the burial site, found the ancient manuscript, knew it was worth something, and took it back home to their relatively poor village and sold it to a local dealer in antiquities. Then he, with contacts in Cairo, tried to resell it for a much higher price. And at one point, it, through various methods, finally got to Switzerland, when some scholars in the 1970s actually had a chance to see it in a hotel room. for only about 30 minutes. And they looked at it, but they didn't identify it as the Gospel of Judas because they didn't get a chance to see the final page where it says, this is the Gospel about Judas, or some renderings are the Gospel of Judas, but it's more about Judas than by Judas. Anyway, so they didn't know for sure that it was this Gospel, and so they only had about $300,000, which certainly seems like a lot of money, but the man wanted $3 million. And so the sale didn't go through. Then the text eventually traveled to the United States, where this Egyptian man ended up putting it into a safety deposit box for over 10 years, where the humidity was not controlled at all, and it would get damp and then dry out and get damp, and it was very badly deteriorated. When he finally ended up selling it to a woman who had known him for some years, and along the way, leaves that is part of it were taken off. A woman smuggled some of them out and then tried to resell them, because you can imagine if it's worth $300,000 or $3 million, that a few pages might be worth, a few thousand dollars. So why not steal some?
I'm sorry. About 30 seconds here.
Anyway, it eventually surfaced through this woman who tried to resell it. And then National Geographic got involved, and they wanted to get some profit out of it, certainly, and sensationalized its content to a great degree, at least in my opinion.
Dr. Daniel Hoffman is Associate Professor of History at Lee University in Cleveland, Tennessee, and he's author of the book The Status of Women and Gnosticism, Irenaeus to Tertullian. He's written the cover story. I do recommend you read this. This is a great summary and also explanation for the hoopla surrounding The Fictitious Gospel of Judas, the title, The Fictitious Gospel of Judas and Its Sensational Promotion. Dr. Hoffman, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate it a lot.
You know, the early Christians were fully aware of the Gnostic heresy. They knew it was there. And they fought to elevate the true scriptures and exclude these false gospels from the canon. They recognized it for what it is. It wasn't the truth. It was an error. And they were quite bold about it. Now, we need to continue that fight, not only on issues like the Gospel of Judas, but the fight against the legitimacy of these Gnostic Gospels, which seem to have a lot of play in the world and even among some Christians. Please stand with us as we defend the faith and teach the truth of classical historic Christianity by joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's our monthly or annual donor program. Everyone who joins between now and the end of the year, we'll get our new I Have Issues t-shirt. Now, you can join online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. By check, just write us at Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can also join the Reformation Club by credit card. Our resource line number, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. We got 354 members now. We want 300 by the end of the year.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Christianity in a Pagan World, Lessons from Ancient Israel and Early Christianity, and Confessional Lutheranism in the Ecumenical World are the themes for the annual symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. This year's symposia begin January 16th and end on January 19th. Now, for a complete list of speakers, symposia schedule, or to register online, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call 260-452-2241, 260-452-2241. The fellowship alone is worth the registration fee, and you can experience the Christ-centered, cross-focused worship life at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. It's the 2006 Symposia Series, January 16th through the 19th at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. For more information, issuesetc.org or call 260-452-2241.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The newest member to sit on the Federal Communications Commission is not a fan of a la carte pricing. Robert McDowell, who took his seat in June, told a group of investors that for all intents and purposes, cable choice is already available. Kim Troby reports that's not the feeling of family advocates.
What if you don't like anything you see on, say, Spike TV?
They've been called indecent, vulgar, and obscene. Here to play Coming Undone.
You don't want it coming into your house, but with most cable systems, even if you never watch it, you have no choice but to pay for the content. With his opposition, Commissioner McDowell made it a virtual certainty consumers will not see cable choice anytime soon. But Pat Truman of the Alliance Defense Fund says FCC Chairman Kevin Martin has been working to have a solid majority in favor of the idea.
And now we know that at least two are solidly against cable choice, and we would have to rely on gaining one additional vote for cable choice.
Commissioner McDowell used to work in the cable industry. Dan Isett of the Parents Television Council says it's time to sever all those ties.
Certainly he should not be trumpeting the industry's talking points on this. He's in a position to regulate them.
The cable industry is lobbying hard to squash a la carte cable, both at the FCC and on Capitol Hill. Isett says they're trying to form a monopoly.
I can't think of another industry that is subsidized in that way. You don't have to go buy a copy of Maxim just to get a copy of Field & Stream.
He says you shouldn't have to pay for Spike TV if all you want is the Disney Channel. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
Congress has the authority to direct the FCC to offer a la carte programming. Chairman Martin recently sent a report to them saying it was a good idea. Congress has not acted, and few see the possibility of that legislation passing under the new Congress. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Wallace. How are you handling the holiday stress? Do you hurry up to catch up? On the next Woman to Woman show, lifestyle coach Dr. Terry Lyles offers some encouraging news. You can go full speed, all out, and get away with it, as long as you build in recovery time. What is recovery time, and how do you do that? Find out next time, Woman to Woman.
Saturday mornings at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Martin Luther is the author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December. It's titled From Heaven Above. It's the perfect Christmas gift for your young child or grandchild. From Heaven Above is published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this new children's book at issuesetc.org. From Heaven Above by Martin Luther, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. For the next hour, it's open lines. The first part of open lines here in the last hour of the program is going to be audio open lines. We're going to hear some stuff. Bishop N.T. Wright, the Bishop of Durham and a guest on this program, weighs in on what he thinks of the Episcopal Church USA and some of the stuff they're trying to pull in worldwide Anglicanism. We'll hear a few sound bites from a representative of the conservative Jewish wing they were mulling over today, whether or throughout this week, whether or not they should have gay rabbis, and they made a decision. We'll tell you what it is here in just a minute and get your reaction to it. And then Vice President Dick Cheney's daughter is famous for being a lesbian. Now she's doubly famous because she's pregnant. We'll hear the story from ABC News. Coming up here during Audio Open Lines, and then in the second part of Audio Open Lines, starting at 5 o'clock, Sound Bite of the Week. That's four sound bites we play for you. All we ask you to do is give us a call and tell us which one do you think is the Issues Etc. Sound Bite of the Week, and why. It's not a guessing game. There are no wrong answers. You just simply vote and be ready to tell us why. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address. You can send us questions or comments or reaction to some of this audio during open lines. issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, we've talked twice that I remember with Bishop N.T. Wright. He's a famous New Testament scholar, most famous lately for what is called the New Perspective on Paul. And we talked to him about that. We also talked to him recently about a book he'd written on the problem of evil. He is unique among scholars, not completely unique, but he stands out among scholars. as someone who actually takes the Bible seriously. And from my conversations with him, he seems to take the gospel seriously, too. And he's no lightweight, that's for sure. He also kind of stands out like a sore thumb in Anglicanism. If your only picture of Anglicanism is the Episcopal Church USA, the American wing of the Anglican Communion. Well, he weighed in recently on what he thinks of the Episcopal Church USA. This is Bishop N.T. Wright. This is what he had to say about the consecration of an openly gay bishop and, in a sense, how unprecedented it was even in the Anglican Communion.
There's been something done which everybody knew would have the effect of breaking the fellowship of the worldwide church, the consecration of Gene Robinson.
You know, I don't think I've heard anybody openly say, we've talked with a lot of Episcopalians and several Anglicans about this. I don't think anyone openly said they knew it would break the communion. And they did it anyway. But that's what Bishop N.T. Wright says. They knew that consecrating Gene Robinson to be the Bishop of New Hampshire back in 2003 and going through with it over and against the objections of the Anglican Communion, they knew it would break the fellowship, break the communion. I have a hard time getting some of our guests who talk about this issue to even speak in terms about a broken communion. But Bishop N.T. Wright seems to say that was enough to do it, the consecration of the first openly gay bishop. Bishop Wright also says that the Anglican Communion's ruling bodies defied the consecration of Gene Robinson.
There has never before been a time when all of those bodies have said very definitely, we are not going down this road, and then one particular province has said, oh yes, we are, and have gone ahead and done it.
It's really easy for us to think, because it's the Episcopal Church USA, and we tend to think of all things USA, it's easy for us to think that the Episcopal Church is like this 1,000-pound gorilla in worldwide Anglicanism. Guess what? It isn't. It's one of the smallest provinces of the Anglican Communion, but it's one of the richest. So when it did what it did, the consecration of Gene Robinson as the first openly gay bishop, it was in many ways not only saying, well, we're just a little corner here, let us do what we want. No, they were thumbing their nose at Anglicans worldwide, 77 million of them. Wouldn't it be nice to have somebody like Bishop Wright here in America? It's very difficult, and we've had a few on, but it's very difficult to get bishops here in America to talk like that in the Anglican Communion. I imagine there are people who say, Bishop Wright, would you come be our bishop, please? I want to hear what you think about Bishop Wright's comments. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio as we come to you live this Thursday, the 7th of December. Issues, etc. at kfuo.org. Now, Bishop N.T. Wright breaks company with the former Bishop John Shelby Spong when it comes to the divinity of Christ. Listen to this.
There is a danger of watering down the divinity of Jesus as though to make it either easier for people to believe or to make it less threatening for people of other faiths who may be confronted with the claim that Jesus is Lord.
I guess Spong is the one that everyone thinks about, because Spong actually, he didn't just deny the divinity of Christ. He comes fairly close to denying the existence of Christ in any historical sense. He talks about the Christ of faith, the Christ in the heart, the cosmic Christ. Very little about the historical Christ. I know he thinks Jesus may have existed, but certainly not in any way related to what the New Testament says. But that's not a unique position, actually, when it comes to the exclusive claims of Jesus Christ. In fact, the newly elected presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, Catherine Jefford Shorey, one of the very first things she had to say in a press conference was that while Christians may be able to claim that their way of salvation is Jesus, they cannot claim that that's the only way of salvation. In fact, she said something like, if we claim to have the only way to God, we're putting God in a very small box. That's what she had to say. Now, Bishop N.T. Wright, Anglican Bishop of Durham in England, says Jesus isn't only the Christian's way to God.
The other gods and lords who are out there, whoever they may be, are actually called to account before the crucified and risen Jesus. That's pretty well non-negotiable in classic Christianity. It would be tragic if any Christian leader started just pulling that down as though you could dispense with the basic claims about Jesus.
It not only would be tragic, it is tragic because that's exactly what's happening. And it's not only happening in the Episcopal Church USA. Care to react to Bishop Wright? Now, here's a guy who is not only a scholar in his own right, but also willing to stand up in his church as very much a voice in the wilderness and say, not only is the direction that the Episcopal Church has gone wrong, but those who deny the divinity of Christ, those who deny Christ as the only way of salvation for all men, are wrong. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. I like the way he put it in that last cut. He always comes at these things a little bit different than you would expect someone to, especially a New Testament scholar. There's not a lot of pat answers when it comes to N.T. Wright. I think that's what makes him a good guest on the program. And his response to other gods and other lords, he doesn't sit there and argue that there are no other gods and there are no other lords, although I think he would argue that in a biblical sense. What he says is, hey, if there are other gods and other lords, guess what? They're going to be bowing down to Jesus. That's pretty clear from the New Testament. Yeah, you go ahead and talk about other gods. You go ahead and talk about other ways, other lords, other saviors. You go ahead. Just remember, the New Testament says, They all bowed down to Jesus in the end. I don't think I've ever heard anyone address it that way. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio during audio open lines. issuesetc@kfuo.org. What do you have for me here? Ah, yes, thank you very much. I've been watching this all week. The question was going to come around sooner or later. The Jewish population in the United States is very small, but very visible and very vocal. Not saying anything negative there. And most people understand that just because someone is Jewish doesn't necessarily mean that they're walking around in black with curls coming down the side of their head and keeping kosher. They understand that being Jewish is sometimes just an ethnic thing. Sometimes it is a religious thing. Generally recognize three branches of Judaism in the United States. Your Orthodox or Hasidic Jews, who pretty much try and keep the Old Testament statutes to the letter, their interpretation, but mostly the Talmud. Okay? And then on the other end of the spectrum, there is Reformed Judaism, which is anything goes, and I don't even think they advocate the existence of God as a hard and fast principle. Then in between, the group of interest in these next bit of sound bites, conservative Judaism. It's an odd little adjective, isn't it? Conservative, we'll see what that means. They were meeting this week to discuss the issue of homosexuality, and in particular, whether or not the congregations of conservative Judaism could have gay rabbis. Let's find out more about this story from Rabbi Jerome Epstein. He's executive vice president of the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism. Now, Rabbi Epstein says that synagogues and seminaries don't have to ordain gays.
Just because we say it is okay for gays or lesbians to be rabbis does not mean that the congregation is forced to accept a gay or lesbian if they feel that that is not appropriate religiously.
Now, when I heard this, I thought to myself, okay, he seems to have gone on to question number two before answering question number one. Are they going to have gay rabbis? Apparently so, but he wants to make sure that no one gets the impression that you're going to have a gay rabbi. This is the way it usually happens among Christians and apparently among Jews, too. Now, look, come on. We're not saying you have to do this. We're just saying let us do it. Oddly enough, that little way of thinking, yeah, we're going to deviate from God's word pretty significantly here, but we're not going to impose it on anybody. So don't get worried. If you don't want to have a gay rabbi, you don't have to. But let us have one. That little way of thinking is very common among Christians, too. Even Christians who call themselves conservative, like the conservative Jews, who apparently did decide that they're going to have gay rabbis, it just won't be mandatory. That's good to know, because it would have really been earth-shaking for them to say that every rabbi in their synagogues must be gay. That would have been earth-shaking. At least they didn't require gay rabbis. Rabbi Epstein says that the split decision on gay rabbis did prompt some resignations in the group that made this decision.
Four individuals did resign. I wouldn't say it's in protest, but because they felt that the process was one in which they no longer felt comfortable.
That's, an interesting way of describing the situation. I don't know why the members of this group who were making the decision on homosexuality and gay rabbis resigned. I did understand going into it that there were four votes against the sanctioning of gay rabbis in conservative Judaism. Now, it might be a coincidence that there were four resignations from the committee. Might be a coincidence, might not. But they didn't resign in protest. Come on, no one was protesting. They just didn't feel like the process served their needs. Or maybe they felt like they didn't want to be a part of the group anymore if this was going to be the decision. What do you think about this decision? It was made yesterday by conservative Judaism to permit, not require, but permit homosexual rabbis in their synagogues. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You can also email us here during audio open lines, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I mean, now we can begin. You used to be able to count on one hand the major religious groups in the United States that advocated homosexuality or permitted it to the point of advocacy. It used to be the kook, the lunatic fringe. It used to be the United Church of Christ. It used to be the Episcopal Church, USA. You toss in there, well, of the other denominations that actually openly advocate it or permit it to the point of advocacy, it gets a little fuzzy after that. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America permits to the point of advocacy. The United Methodist Church, yeah, a little bit of that too. The Presbyterian Church USA, even though on their books they still say no, in practice they say yes. And there are several others. And now we can count among them as religious groups in the United States, albeit a small one, conservative Judaism, that permits to the point of advocacy homosexual clergy. Any thoughts? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Finally, Rabbi Jerome Epstein, executive vice president of conservative Judaism, says that conservative Jews who oppose gay marriage might consider becoming Orthodox Jews.
We will have to help individuals as well as congregations deal with the pain that they may have by having strong-seated religious values challenged.
We're going to have to deal with the pain of having strong-seated religious values challenged. At least they're not just showing them the door. Although that might come to that too. But this is the way it works. I didn't make this up, but someone far more intelligent than I am made it up. I just quote it without any citation. This is how error enters any belief system. I think especially Christianity, but this is how error enters. You've heard me say it before. First, error just sits in the corner, doesn't ask for a place at the table, and just says, I just want to sit here in the corner quietly. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to say anything. Don't even acknowledge my presence. Just let me be in the room with you. The next thing that happens, step two, is error asks for a place at the table. Not the best place, but just a place. Come on. I won't even say anything. I'll keep my hands to myself. Just give me a place at the table. And people say, that can't hurt, can it? Because after all, error is harmless. It's benign. Well, step three is, error says, I would like the head of the table. That's actually happening in some Christian church bodies. And then finally, if things continue without anyone objecting, error asks truth to leave the room. Or maybe there's an intermediate step where it says, truth, you come and sit at my feet now, and you keep your mouth shut.
You know, Pastor Whedon, in Bible class, like 2 weeks ago, he quoted Charles Porterfield Crouth.
I know.
Okay.
I was going to say Crouth, but whenever I say
he said there was three. I just called him on the phone just to make sure I got
it really?
Right.
Okay, let's hear it.
You know me. I like to
give it to
my sources.
Give it to me.
First, error demands toleration.
Mm-hmm.
Then it demands acceptance. And then it demands the suppression of the truth.
I like that better than what I said.
Yeah.
Although mine has...
You had four steps.
Well, I had four steps because, well, at least I've observed that error is very patient. That's the amazing thing. How patient heresy is. It'll wait forever. There's nothing more pitiful, by the way, than an impatient heretic. They usually get really impatient about the time they have to retire. Or when they see the end of their life approaching. But there's nothing more pitiful than an impatient heretic. They lose all their patience. Then they start kind of tipping their hand and making it clear what they're up to. And while it may amuse, it's also kind of sad. Not that I can really bring myself to feel sorry for the impatient heretic. I want to hear from you on the acceptance of gay rabbis in conservative Judaism. It is now a very odd world that we live in where conservative Judaism accepts gay rabbis. Doesn't require them, but accepts them. It puts a whole new light on the word conservative, doesn't it? Conservative by what definition? Maybe by the same definition used by a lot of so-called conservative church bodies. 505-7850-1800-730-2727 or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Or what do you think about what Bishop N.T. Wright had to say about the Episcopal Church USA? That is about as meddlesome as an Episcopalian or an Anglican will ever get. What you heard from Bishop N.T. Wright, 505-7850-1800-730-2727. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Just a few minutes left here. Then we're going to play Soundbite of the Week. Paul is on the line calling from his car. Hi, Paul. Paul, welcome. Paul, are you there? No, he's not there. Just a little technical glitch here. Let's see what Josh has to say. Line two, there, buzz for Josh. Welcome, Josh. Again, I think the callers are still here at some point. We will get it worked out. Don't worry, Buzz. We'll get it worked out. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address during audio open lines, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Want to give another try here, Buzz? Yeah, let's try line two and Josh, please. Josh, you there? I hear a beautiful empty sound, though. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll be playing Soundbite of the Week. If you've never heard it before, you'll want to participate. We play four soundbites from this week's Issues Etc. audio. One of them's from a sermon. One of them is from a guest. We pull it from wherever we can find them. What we think are remarkable or interesting soundbites. And then we ask you to vote in the last half hour of the program for what you think is your Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week and why. It doesn't have to be something you agree with. In fact, you can disagree. It doesn't have to be something that you, something that makes you happy to hear it. No. In fact, it might be something that outrages you. But for some reason, it is a soundbite that when you hear it, you want to hear it again. That's what makes a soundbite of the week. We'll be playing that here in just a few minutes on Issues Etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's see if we can do Josh here. I will. Thank you. Josh is on the line. Josh, welcome to Issues Etc. Okay. Hey, it's Thursday. It's Thursday. Thursday is one of those kind of days. It's kind of like the Monday of the weekend, you know? It's the day before everything begins to fall apart, and sometimes things begin to fall apart a little early.
We can count on one hand the times I've had glitches that are technical in nature this year. And this is one of them.
Our Issues Etc. is underwritten by LCMS World Relief. They are out on the front lines across the world. While we worry about things big and small, they are worrying about some mighty big problems and people who, without their relief, really have very few avenues to get help. LCMS World Relief is bringing the touch of mercy, Christ-centered, cross-focused relief to those in need of man-made and natural disasters. To find out more about LCMS World Relief, you can give them a call. Their toll-free number, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, or you can go to our website and you'll find the logo for LCMS World Relief right there at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Click on it and you'll find everything you want to know about Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief and what they're doing all across the globe to help those who are in real need, bringing with that relief the message of Christ and Him crucified. When we come back from this break, it's time to play Soundbite of the Week. You vote. First we play all four, then you vote. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc at kfuo.org. Jonathan writes this from Clinton, New Jersey. He says, listening to your back issue from this week on Christian symbols in the public square, we talked about that earlier this week, I was struck by those who preferred to have the manger be the symbol. We did have a few callers who said they wanted the manger to be the symbol that would represent Christianity if Christianity were free to put any symbol it wanted to in the public square. One lady even said that we should have both the cross and the manger. And that's what hit me the most, says Jonathan. He quotes the Nicene Creed. For us men and for our salvation, he came down from heaven and was made man. Jonathan continues, okay, but why the manger? Why not the Virgin Mary? How is the cradle symbolic of the incarnation? It's a good question. Should it not be the seed? The ancient church was fond of the icon of the Virgin holding a child, the child, on her lap, who was himself holding a cross. Now that might say something. Jonathan, thank you very much for, you know, we were talking about this before we came on the air. What a fitting symbol. The Virgin Mary, this is just the way that the church confesses it. For us and for our salvation, he came down from heaven and was incarnate of the Virgin Mary and made man. And all of that is pictured right there. You know, those early Christians really did understand something, especially about how they say what it is Christianity is, even when it's just a symbol. The Virgin Mary holding her child, the Christ child, and Christ holding his cross. Try to get that into the public square. Fat chance. When we come back, Soundbite of the Week. Stay tuned.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.